Welcome to episode 301 of the Energy Talks podcast. I'm energy and climate journalist Markham Hislop. A year ago today, Alberta Premier Danielle Smith released the Emissions Reduction and Energy Development Plan, which she claimed was the province's climate plan. I wrote a column at the time arguing that it was an oil and gas marketing plan that had absolutely nothing to do with climate change or reducing greenhouse gas emissions. As it turns out, and very unfortunately, I was correct. The Pembina Institute has released an assessment of Alberta's progress under the plan and, not surprisingly, has found there has been precisely none. This is bad news for Canada because Alberta accounts for 38% of national emissions, even though it comprises only 13% of the population. Even worse, Smith's United Conservative Party government opposes every single federal climate policy that's being proposed. To discuss Alberta's appalling lack of climate ambition, I'm joined by MC Bouchard, Pembina's Oil and Gas Program Director. So welcome to the interview, MC.
Thank you, Markham. Happy to be here, and thanks for your engagement.
Well, first of all, congratulations on your appointment. You came, you were appointed in, took your position in January. You have a long background in the oil and gas industry and then some time with the Alberta government. Maybe just give our listeners a brief overview of your experience, please.
Great. I'm an engineer by training. I have a degree in fuels and materials engineering as well as environmental engineering. I used both my degrees in my 23 years in the oil and gas industry at Imperial Oil in Canada and ExxonMobil in the US. Spent a lot of my career in safety, security, health, and environment roles, as well as engineering, maintenance, operations. Left in 2021 to pursue, playing a more active part in the energy transition. Spent 18 months with the government of Alberta as an assistant deputy minister in their ESG secretariat. And now I'm with the Pembina Institute, wanting to be, understanding how think tanks, influencers, participate in that really important area of energy transition.
Well, I want to set some context for our conversation today. And one of the, I think it's important, back in 2019, after the federal government, the Trudeau Liberals were elected as government of Canada, I wrote a column in which I argued that all roads achieving Canada's climate plans ran through Alberta. Without Alberta, Canada cannot achieve anything. It's just, and the reason for that is Alberta is the most heavily industrialized province in the country. It has the Alberta oil sands, which is Canada's largest industrial project. That accounts for 12 or 13% of national emissions all by itself. The oil and gas industry in Canada is 26, 28%. And I want to make the point to our listeners, MC, that I have been through this data rigorously for years. I've got the Environment and Climate Change Canada spreadsheet with all of the data broken down by province and economic sector. And I've interviewed Kevin Byrne of S&P Global, who's an expert on oil sands emissions. We're not going to have a discussion about narrative. We're not promoting some kind of agenda here. This is very data and evidence-based, the critique of that we're going to provide today. And frankly, the Alberta government has, and the industry has done almost nothing. And what it's done, when in the face of rising pressure from the federal government, it almost abandoned all of its efforts to reduce emissions in the oil sands in particular, in favor of carbon capture utilization and storage. It put all its eggs in that basket. So instead of continuing with the research it had done on solvent substitution and increasing efficiencies in other areas, it's a one-trick pony. And that's not going well. And of course, none of it's been built, so there haven't been any emissions reductions. I'm sorry to be long-winded here, but I think this is really important context for even our Canadian listeners, but particularly our listeners in Europe and the United States. So maybe if you could respond to that and give us your take, you've been on the inside of this industry. What's your take on its emissions and Alberta's emissions?
Well, I think, you know, to go back to the beginning, the largest opportunities to reduce emissions are in Alberta. So in order to meet, you know, Canada's international commitments, in order to meet our plan under the 2030 emissions reduction plan, we need Alberta to participate. We need the oil and gas companies to participate. And as you point out, we need the oil sands companies to participate with meaningful action. I think the, you know, we talk about all of that. Maybe I'll break it down a little bit more. We like to talk about oil sands a little bit separately than, you know, conventional oil and gas, because the opportunities, as you pointed out, are different. So, you know, for conventional oil and gas, there's opportunities in methane, and there's been some progress made in methane. There's more progress to be made. There's measurement, you know, opportunities. Better measurement will help us understand. I think we you know, I personally like to give some credit where credit is due, that there has been progress in terms of methane emissions abatement. And you're right, the oil sands companies, you know, have made progress in terms of emissions intensity, efficiencies, optimization. But now we are at the point where a step change is required. You know, they've been talking about their foundational project. The Pathways Alliance has been talking about their foundational project for a while. They've recently submitted, you know, a regulatory application for the CO2 pipeline, the 400-kilometer pipeline. I mean, those are all good signs, but, you know, we need more action, right?
Well, we do indeed. And let's talk about methane emissions, because this was the low, always considered the low-hanging fruit. And out of Alberta's, and again, let's get to the data, out of Alberta's 256 megatons of emissions per year, 39 megatons of those were from the natural gas side, which would be all methane emissions. The Alberta government last year claimed that it had hit its internal 45% methane emission reduction plan. And I've been to the Alberta Energy Regulator site, and I've seen the claim on their site that they, in fact, have hit that number. I don't believe it. There's no methodology, there's no evidence, there's no data advanced to back up that claim. And when I go to the federal national inventory data, and I did this with three economists who work in the emissions data, including a couple of your colleagues, and all we could find was a 33% reduction.
And
Sir, go ahead.
There's too many questions right now, right? There's too many data sets. There's too many, you know, different ways of calculating, you know, emissions. So that's why, you know, as part of our advocacy for the federal methane regulation amendments, you know, we need to commit to measurement. First and foremost, right? So that we stop the debate, we stop the trying to compare and contrast the federal data set and the provincial data set, and really focus on understanding the emissions and, like you pointed out, executing, operationalizing the reduction opportunities that are simple, technologically feasible, and actually cost effective. Because keeping the methane in the pipe, you know, gives you the ability to sell more natural gas. So there's all of that. It should be attractive to industry, to investors, to regulators, to, you know, all stakeholders.
Yeah, that one of the reasons why methane emissions were considered the low-hanging fruit is because every molecule that stays in the pipe is a molecule you get to sell.
Right.
You know, so why, if you were a gas company, if you were an oil company, why wouldn't you think that? Why wouldn't you be prepared to support that, particularly when the federal and provincial governments were coming to the table with money to help you offset whether your pneumatic actuator or your vents or your whatever it was that you needed to fix, and replace, you know, you've got, you have that subsidized. Why wouldn't you be in support of that? But here's another problem that the industry has not admitted and not really confronted, and that is the poor measurement. It says, oh, yes, we understand our measurement isn't great. Well, what measurement meant was that once or twice a year, an employee would walk up to a tank or a pipeline, and they would point a little thermal gun at it and take a reading. And the problem with that is, of course, that methane emissions rise and fall. They peak. And some of them are, you know, there's a vent a vent left open, something on a tank, and then it gets closed. So yeah. You had a super emitter, now it's not a super emitter. And we have all of these new technologies now that are better, like remote sensing and methane satellites and so on. And studies are finding that the amount of methane emitted is 1.5 to 2 times greater than the estimates. So if we say 45%, it's probably closer to 22.5%. We're way overestimating the progress that we've actually made. And, you know, we have the problem with the data sets that we've talked about earlier, which just dilutes the whole impact of the one area that the industry says it has actually made progress on.
Yeah, it introduces some uncertainty. So clearly, you know, technology is now available to improve the way to measure. I think having been there myself, you know, operating companies tend to be action focused. So they'll say, don't bother me with measuring. I'll just go and fix the leaks, or I'll just go and tighten the valves and, you know, like stop the fugitive emissions. But we need both, right? So that's why we need engagement from a variety of stakeholders that say, no, we need more than just, you know, mitigating the methane. We want to understand where we're at now and where we're going to be tomorrow. So, I think with the proposed federal amendments to the current regulation, you know, if we incorporate rigorous measurement, I think we are moving in the right direction to improve certainty around where we're at now.
Yeah, and that's a problem because, you know, the federal and provincial targets were 45%. Uh-huh. Then the federal government came in and said, look, we need to do something here. So let's bump that up to 75%. And Premier Smith came back and said, no, we're not going to do that. And furthermore, you don't have the constitutional authority to do it. Completely ignoring the fact that for the past 5 years, the provincial government, the Alberta government, has been operating under an equivalency agreement with the federal government, which it accepted the federal government's constitutional authority. I mean, this is the state of the debate that we're in. The level of discussion between the federal government and the provincial government is, and the federal government keeps trying to make, you know, move the goalposts, make things stricter, make some progress. And the provincial government comes back with these nonsensical arguments that have absolutely no basis in reality or law. And it's, you know, observers like myself as an energy, I just frustrates the heck out of me. Because this is such an important issue. And yet here we are, we can't even have an evidence-based conversation, even a reality-based conversation. I don't know. As someone who's been on both sides of in fact, now you've had your foot in three different camps, the industry, the provincial government, and the think tank. So I don't know, what is your take on that problem?
Right. You point to a lot of different issues, but clearly we are advocating for the government of Alberta to seek equivalency, actually begin the work to seek equivalency as soon as possible. You know, at the end of the day, the debate, and if no equivalency agreements are reached, it makes it harder for industry to comply. And at the end of the day, we miss out on an opportunity to really make significant reductions in methane emissions, which are, the case for action is understood. As I said before, the solutions are there, economically feasible. So the right thing to do is to seek equivalency as soon as possible.
Well, I would certainly agree with that, MC. Now, you, all the years that you spent in the industry, I was shocked a couple of years ago. I interviewed two experts. These are people who worked in the industry. One of them was in liability management for most of his career. And I was told something that I found, frankly, hard to understand. So when the various departments, like your department in ExxonMobil or Imperial Oil, comes to the table at budget time, and you say, we want to mitigate some emissions, and we want to spend X millions of dollars to do that. And the management team looks at that and says, the only time, capital that we're going to allocate are those projects that have a net positive return. If we can't make money on the capital that we allocate and spend, we're not going to do it. Well, maybe on emissions, methane emissions, you could argue that you're getting extra molecules to sell, so maybe you're making money there. But all the other emissions, oil sands, conventional, well, you name it, it's not, you. There is no net positive. It's a net negative. And that industry's perverse approach to how it allocates capital is really, in my mind, one of the fundamental issues that never gets talked about, but really needs to be addressed. And now, have I got it right? I'd be interested in what your perspective is.
I can only speak to my personal experience, which, as I said, was with Imperial Oil in Canada and Exxon in the US. And to be honest with you, Markham, that was not my experience on how we made decisions on capital investment. And I'm not talking about things that are confidential. There are things that are in the public domain. We prioritize regulatory compliance as we considered it to be our license to operate. So in my experience, we always had the opportunity to advocate during the regulatory process, development of regulations as we're going through today. And as a company, we advocated, we provided evidence-based information on the pros and cons of proposed regulation. But once the regulation is in place, we invested what we needed to invest to comply. That was first and foremost. Secondly, and also that's in the public domain, we made risk-based decisions on discretionary projects. So the projects that you may describe, if they were not considered to be, providing an economic return, we assess them on the basis of how much risk they reduced. And the risks that we considered were safety, environment, and reputational risks. So that was my experience in the companies that I was in. So no, I would say it was not just all about making money and on capital investments.
No, I really appreciate your perspective on that, because yeah. I assumed when I did the interviews with these individuals that not every company was the same. And so it's good to get feedback on different approaches. So let's stop beating up on the companies for a while and talk about the Alberta government. So there are six actions that you're recommending that the Alberta government take. And one of them is to set emissions targets, because that was one of the big criticisms of the Emissions Reduction and Energy Development Plan. Every climate plan on the planet has emissions targets except this one. And I think that's a good recommendation, frankly.
Right. I mean, of course, this is so important. Why is it important? It's because, climate policy, climate planning is economic policy. It's planning for a strong economic future, right? I didn't mention that I spent a little bit of time in the military, and there was a saying which was, fail to plan, plan to fail, right? So you need a plan, you need targets, you need to know what's achievable in setting your targets. You need to know where the different sectors are going, how the different sectors interplay with each other. For example, cleaning up the grid, you can do it in parallel, but you need a clean grid in order to reduce emissions from other sectors like buildings, for example. And so that's why we felt strongly that that was first and foremost, the top recommendation, very pragmatic. They can do that within the next year.
Yeah, this has been really frustrating, because Your predecessor, Jan Gorski, I've interviewed him many times on this. And when the federal government's emissions targets were announced, your Pembina released a report, a press release, and it said, look, there is a way, there's a pathway to meet these targets. One of them would be, for example, instead of looking at 45% reduction in fugitive methane emissions, be more aggressive, be more ambitious, get it up to 90%. That gives you your immediate, helps you to meet the immediate goals while you make the investments in those processes and technologies that will help you meet the medium to long-term goals. I thought it was a very sensible strategy. And it was, you know, in people that I talked to within the industry, it was savaged. Like people, they were very critical of it, but it was an actual plan. It was the only organization I saw in that whole debate that said, hey, you know what? Here's how you can do it.
Uh-huh.
And so I thought I was very disappointed in the industry's response to that.
Right. I mean, and, you know, again, going back to giving credit to where credit is due, like I think in Alberta, we have an example where, you know, looking at a subsector like coal-fired electricity production, you know, there was a target, there was a sectoral path to get there. There were policies, support programs, investments, technologies defined, and which provided a clear, you know, this is where we're going as a subsector, and create certainty for the electricity producers, the investors, right? So that's we think, a strong example of what needs to be done now across all of the sectors. And of course, especially starting with the oil and gas and the oil sands, particularly understanding how we will get there.
The second recommendation was to strengthen Alberta's industrial carbon pricing incentive pricing system. It's called TIER. And just last year, the federal government and the provincial government renegotiated the equivalency agreement around TIER, and they doubled the, well, let me back up. Under TIER, the stringency of the carbon pricing system is supposed to go improve by 1% per year. Then the federal government negotiated a 2% per year. So it became, the stringency increased by double per year. But I talked to one of your colleagues who said, really, to get to the targets, you need to increase it by 5 times per year, which would be a significant increase. But now we're locked into this 5-year program, like a 5-year agreement that's very difficult to change. And the federal government has responded by saying, we're going to put on an oil and gas emissions cap and layer a cap and trade system on top of the industrial emitters carbon tax. And industry, of course, is not happy about that at all, because it's double the complexity and now you have two sets of regulations. And I get it. I really don't understand why, when the feds were sitting at the table with the province, they didn't raise this. And do it with the one tax, the one system that was already in place. So I'd be curious, how do you think that they're going to strengthen the TIER, given where we're at now and the fact that we're, you know, 1 year into a 5-year agreement?
Right. And and as you know, the TIER system under different names has been in place for a while in Alberta, and is, you know, demonstrated to really enable and incentivize emissions reduction. I mean, the federal, so the price of a ton of CO2, you know, is set to 2030. I think that's helpful because, again, it creates certainty and clarity for the investors and the companies. When we say that they need to strengthen it, I think that's, you know, kind of applicable to any output-based pricing system like TIER. You always have to assess its effectiveness, and you always have to make improvements in, for example, setting even ever more demanding performance out of the companies. That's how you get the emissions reduction. So that is really what we wanted to focus on, is to make sure that in the years to come, the performance standards are demanding enough that it leads to the outcomes that we're looking for, especially when it comes to CCUS, right? The other item that we want to point out, again, the government of Alberta needs to continue monitoring its effectiveness, forecast what's going to happen in the future, because if you do a whole bunch of CCUS and companies now have a whole bunch of credits available, if the credits flood the market, then it depresses the price. It is, you know, not going to work as intended. So there were those two aspects. And while, you know, of course, TIER needs to be equivalent to the federal OBPS system, you know, if they tighten the benchmarks, for example, it's going to be more demanding. And that's okay, right? It has to be the meet the minimum. It can be more demanding.
Okay. The third recommendation is to lower the oil sands emission limit. Now, this was proposed. It came out of, it did not come out of the Leach Commission in 2015. I want to make that very clear. I've done a lot of reporting on the handshake agreement between five oil sands CEOs and five environmental groups that happened in 2015. That's where the 100 megaton a year oil sands emissions limit came from. It came from those discussions, and then Environment Minister at the time, Shannon Phillips, and Premier at the time, Rachel Notley, agreed and put it in the 2015 climate plan. It was brought in with legislation. It was never proclaimed. There, in fact, is no oil sands emissions limit. And the Premier keeps talking about how we have an oil sands emissions limit. No, you don't. You have one that you put into that it's sitting on the books, but has no effect in law because it was never proclaimed. And currently the oil sands sit at 84 megatons per year. The problem here is that the Alberta Energy Regulator is forecasting another 600,000 barrels a day of supply being added between now and 2032. The chances are very good that the industry will either bump up or blow past that 100 megatons a year without some serious. That would be a huge blow for Alberta's emissions limit. And I think one of the first things they could do is, first of all, proclaim it and then lower it. You know, put it at 82 or 80 or 80 or something that has some teeth to it, instead of keep talking about, you know, the Premier talking about it as if it exists when it doesn't even exist. That's my problem.
Our perspective on that is that they committed in their, plan to explore that. So that's, you know, it seems that they had an intention. And as we've noted, there's no, at least in the public domain, there's no evidence that they've explored, whatever that means. But again, it's kind of going back to number one, which is sectoral pathways analysis. Set achievable but demanding targets. The oil sands emissions limit would then, you know, kind of flow out of that analysis. Another way to look at it is that the Oil Sands Pathways Alliance, so the larger oil sands producers themselves, have defined a path. So you could, at the very least, use that to inform or partly inform how you're going to, you know, make your next move and set a limit that, again, aligns us with our 2030 emissions plan in Canada.
The fourth recommendation is one that I just interviewed a Calgary-based company 2 days ago that has some bearing on this. It's Ever Technologies. It's an advanced geothermal company. And one of the reason I bring this up, if we're talking about modernizing the mandate of the electricity systems operator and utilities regulator, the government clearly is tinkering with that. It's already given instructions to AESO to come up with a different market different market structure. And it's also given some direction to the Alberta Utilities Commission. But here's the problem. The industry could reduce some emissions through electrification. It says so itself. And I bring up Ever because Ever produces both when it's, you know, it drills holes into the ground a kilometer or 2 kilometers down, and it uses the heat down there to heat up water, bring it to the surface, and then it either can be industrial heat or it can be turned into electricity. So if you were without building new transmission infrastructure up to the oil sands, which is way up in northeastern Alberta, you could begin modernizing some of that production, or sort of electrifying it, using that kind of technology, that advanced geothermal. And downhole side, there's a company out of Calgary called Acceleware that basically builds an electric, it's like a microwave, an RXFL heater that runs off renewable energy, and you could get rid of the natural gas and that's used to create steam that then gets pumped into the SAGD wells, the in situ side of the industry. And so if you could electrify that, and you could get rid of a lot of the emissions if you did something like that. And it seems to me that the industry is just not interested. And if you combine electricity system reform and tied it to emission reduction in the oil sands, and maybe even put government, federal and provincial government money in there, you might have a recipe for making some actual progress. And none of this ever gets put on the public table, never does, seems to be discussed at the government level. I don't know. Do you have any insights into that?
Yeah, well, the technologies you mentioned, I'm not familiar enough to, you know, comment on that. But I'll say that here on this action item, we were not just thinking of electrifying the oil and gas sector, but, you know, clearly electrifying, you know, with clean energy, all of the other sectors in Alberta, benefiting, you know, communities, large and small businesses. You know, I think you're in BC, but I'm in Alberta, you know, myself, like, you know, like providing clean, affordable electricity. And also that is often, as we've seen in other provinces, an incentive to, you know, attract, you know, larger companies that are looking for clean electricity as a way to meet their own, you know, emissions targets. So we were, you know, recommending this step that would benefit not just the oil and gas sector, but all of the sectors in Alberta.
Yeah, the problem there is I'm just, while you were talking, I was looking at the spreadsheet of the from the federal government about the emissions. And the problem Alberta has is that after the oil and gas industry, which makes about 145 megatons out of the province's 256 megatons, so it only there it's distributed amongst, you know, buildings at 18 megatons and transportation at 25 megatons, and you know it's very hard it's very costly to reduce the amount of emissions in those sectors per megaton of emissions. Whereas in the oil and gas industry, you've got one industry that's right there. It's, you can make significant reductions in a short period of time while you're squeezing out emissions in all of these other, you know, buildings and electricity and industry and so on. It's a real problem. And if oil and gas isn't on board, finding reductions in other parts of the industry is difficult. The fifth recommendation deals with oil and gas methane emissions. We've talked about that extensively. I don't think we need to talk about it anymore. So the last one is new rules that would pave the way for cost-effective demand-side management measures for electricity use. And this is something that the government, there was an office, and then they eliminated it and rolled it into Emissions Reduction Alberta. There's not much in the way of funding that's been applied to it, but it seems like the demand side of this issue, emissions reduction, is ripe in Alberta to do something about it. What's your take?
Absolutely. And, you know, I think the opportunity is that much stronger in that, you know, we are a growing province. You know, I'm looking down outside my window here. There's like 5 or 6 multi-residential units going up across the block from me. You know, as we're doing that, it's a lot easier to to build in these demand side opportunities, you know, in new building versus retrofits, for example. So the government needs to act on this. We can't keep going backward, you know, as you pointed out, have something in place for a while and then it kind of peters out. So again, we wanted to make that recommendation because it is an impactful action that is achievable, you know, this year.
We've had, a fairly thorough discussion, MC, of the problems that Alberta has around its emissions reduction. But let's get back to what we originally started talking about, which was the plan, the Emissions Reduction and Energy Development Plan, which seems to be all energy development and no emissions reduction. What does the industry, and what I mean by that is the oil and gas industry, what do they think of that plan?
Well, I think I can't speak on their behalf, and I didn't go back and see what they said last year. But again, in the context of, you know, a climate plan or an emissions reduction plan and strategy being, you know, an economic plan or policies, they have to be proponents of this. I think they can see in some of the things that were written more so as an aspiration that how that would benefit them, right? And how that would add certainty for investors and allow our industries and businesses to participate in the ever-growing low-carbon economy that's out there. So, you know, I don't want to speak on their behalf, but if I'm using sort of my experience and knowledge, that's how that should feel to them.
One of the problems with the plan is that when you say aspirational, you're being kind. And I'll give a couple of examples for the listeners. So, for example, the government promotes small modular reactors. There's not a one in the world. It's very theoretical at this point. The Ontario Power and Gas is building one. It might be done by 2030. But really, this technology, even if it's successful, is not expected to be viable until the mid-2030s, maybe even 2040. So that they say, and I can see the attraction for the oil sands, for example. Again, you get heat and you get electricity at the same time. That'd be very economic for them. There are other kinds of new technologies that are coming. Hydrogen would be an example. Now, it's currently uneconomic. Hydrogen is, we're not at any point where an industry like the oil sands could adopt. Well, they can in their upgraders, and you certainly can in petrochemical industry, and you can in refining. So it's not fair to say they can't. But I think in the last couple of years, we now understand hydrogen's limitations a lot better than we did. And my point here is that plan, Smith's plan, is full of relying on future aspirational technologies that may prove out to be economic in the 2030s or 2040s, but probably will be problematic and probably won't. Whereas the things that are ready and today to reduce emissions, to electrify things, you know, with wind and solar and batteries and all of those kinds, that gets actively opposed. That's my problem. This is an incumbent industry, an incumbent economy that says we don't want to change any more than we have to. And this plan basically is like putting up a fence around all of that and trying to keep out the federal government and any. That's, I think, its biggest weakness, in my opinion.
It's hard to disagree. I think that you know, the forward or future looking is important. You know, as you're talking, maybe it's more of a, you know, a strategy. That it's important to know what's coming and what's out there, so you don't make poor decisions now. But as you point out, what's important in a plan is to have some timelines, is to have some actionable items, realistic, achievable, that rely on existing technology. I would say that, you know, the way things get built out there, you have to know what technology you're going to be using for sure in the next 5-6 years, right? So I think that's a fair statement that's where it's really lacking. I believe that, you know, at the time, Minister Savage was transparent about that. I believe that there was some level of commitment to, that said, we need a plan, but, and that's what we've observed here, is that nothing has been put in place.
Yeah, I think, going to be a drag them down. It's going to be a dirty, dirty battle between Alberta and the federal government over the next few years on this, because as we get closer to 2030 and as Canada, and, you know, frankly, I look at the other provinces, Manitoba had a very small increase from 2005 to 2021, as the chart in your report notes, and every other province reduced its emissions. And right. Alberta went up 9% over those years, which, given how big it was to begin with, 9% is a lot. And was almost all down to oil and gas, increase in oil and gas production. And what I'm hearing outside of Alberta from other provinces is, we're tired of bringing our emissions down and Alberta keeps going up, and it doesn't want to bring it down. And this, and we're tired of all of the, you know, the games and the, you know, the phony fights, but with the federal government over this. Some, we have to get serious and we have to get down to it. So on that note, MC, thank you very much for this. This has been a very useful mm-hmm. insight into the issue, and I wish I felt optimistic. I don't, but thank you. We'll have you back again. Now that we know that you're in your new position, we'll have you back for future interviews. Thank you.
Great. I'd love to. Thank you.